morning. Please be seated. The first case on the Southern Panel's oral argument docket this morning is Tuxedo International, Inc. v. Rosenberg, case number 52861. Mr. Boodle, are you ready to proceed for the appellant? Forgive me if I mispronounced your name. I hope I pronounced it correctly.
That's a good job. You can say anything you
like. No. No, I think it's appropriate to call people by their right name.
Your Honor, I've been called so many different variations of it. I'm just pleased to be here.
Okay.
Can I approach?
Yes, please. Uh-huh.
Justices, good morning. May it please the Court, Alan Butel for Tuxedo in this particular matter. And delving right into this point, I think that the first thing I want to say is that in Nevada, I think it's very important that we presumptively honor forum selection clauses. Getting that out of the way, I think then we have to look at cases such as the instant case where the causes of action brought forth by the plaintiff have no relationship or origins from the contract itself. The causes of action are unrelated, do not require an analysis of the contract. The causes of action brought by the plaintiff do not require an interpretation of the contract. And the rights and the duties between the parties really don't flow from the contract as it relates to the causes of action, as in this case. In our case and in the cases where I think the rule that I'm suggesting should apply, the tort claims are unrelated to the contract and they don't flow from the contract or any documents. I guess I would call it a case where we wouldn't have a wolf in sheep's clothing, or in other words, a contract posing as a tort, a contract action posing as a tort, which is, I think, one of the things that we see in the cases where the broad rule is applied so often is there's an intermingling of tort claims and an intermingling of contract claims, and the courts almost uniformly apply that broad rule and say, you know, we're going to honor the forum selection clause. And I think
what are you asking for in your complaint? And I'm not interested in the labels applied to the claims, but what is the relief that Tuxedo requests in the complaint?
The $600,000 plus punitive damages, Your Honor.
The $600,000 that Tuxedo invested in
the $600,000 that made its way from my client Dean Maddox and Tuxedo to Rosenberg's possession, at which point the whole thing evaporates. That's why we saw not contract relief, Your Honor, but exemplary damages. This is the way I believe I put it in the complaint itself.
But restitution of the monies advanced as
well. Absolutely. We want all the money back plus punitive damages for engaging in the tortious conduct that we allege. Yes, ma'am.
And do any of those claims arise under the addendum?
No, ma'am. Our claims, it's my contention, Your Honor, is that while it's true that the documents may find themselves presented in a chronological story told at time of trial to the fact finder, our causes of action do not tie back, nor the relief that we seek tie back to those documents at all. And so I contend that you could take these documents and basically put them in the trash as far as their relationship to the causes of action that we seek in our complaint, which is the theft hyphen conversion by fraud and an unjust enrichment. And then again, I wanted to point out the significance of the relief that we saw specifically, which was exemplary punitive damage.
Well, let's clarify a point as a follow-up to what Justice Pickering has asked.
Yes.
Your argument is that the court should allow you to proceed on your tort claims because they're not derivative or do not involve the contract. Assuming that the court disagreed with you, though, do you concede that we're dealing with an exclusive forum selection clause in these documents?
Well, Your Honor, I'm trying to answer your question as I understand it. If I get off on the wrong trail, then just stop me and I'll start.
It's a simple question.
I don't
you
think
concede?
That this form selection clause governs the conduct that we put in our complaint at all. I got that. Yeah.
But assuming that the court disagrees or assuming that the court accepts an approach that's broader that seems to conflate tort and contract issues, are you conceding that the language contained in these documents constitutes an exclusive forum selection clause in Peru?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Okay.
But I
so what I'd like to know
yes, sir.
Is assuming that, why should this court adopt one of the approaches that would say we're going to disregard the forum selection clause in this case?
Your Honor, I think that we should do that because we would protect parties who come to Nevada in good faith with the intention of conducting business in Nevada. In this case, it is our contention, in any case like that, the forum selection clause, these documents, if you will, the so-called contract, were simply part of the scheme that was used by Mr. Rosenberg and his cohorts to relieve Mr. Maddox and Tuxedo of the money. I don't think that a forum selection clause should be part of the tools of the trade, people who defraud, people who come in good faith to do business in Nevada. In other words, if I put in my fee agreement, a disagreement arising out of this shall be handled in the courts of Argentina, or any service provider in this county could walk the streets getting people to sign contracts, I'll paint your house, I'll do your landscaping, whatever it might be, give me 50% down, anything that comes, any disagreement or disagreement in this case will be construed by the laws of Peru.
Well, but there's a difference. This relationship contemplated performance in Peru, correct?
Yes.
If the relationship had been as represented, the contract would have been performed in Peru. So it's a little different than a landscaper in Las Vegas saying, if you want to sue me, you're going to have to go to Argentina.
Only to the extent, Your Honor, that yes, while parts of this performance that were contemplated in these agreements, the so-called contract, called for Peruvian casinos to have race and sports books and horse books, I believe they call them, installed as a result of my client's performance. His performance wasn't really in Peru. His performance was provided money.
I have a question. Whether or not under the addendum any money was provided, or was it all provided under the MOU and the initial agreement?
The money was provided prior to December of 2005. To be quite frank with you, Your Honor, I couldn't say when exactly how much money was paid exactly when, but I do know that according to Mr. Maddox, the money was paid to Mr. Rosenberg prior to the December 1st agreement, well prior to.
And so the claims for fraud that you're asserting are tied to the formation of the agreement, not to the addendum. Is that fair?
Well, I would say that our claims precede any agreement at all. Our claims really arise from Mr. Rosenberg's intent, if you will. I mean, my pedigree is as a prosecutor, and what I see is Mr. Rosenberg had this scheme laid out in his mind before any documents were prepared. When he met with Dean Maddox between June 16th and the 19th in 2005 on those many occasions in the Bellagio, it was his intent throughout this whole process to relieve Mr. Maddox of his money. That's my contention.
Looking at the so-called forum selection clause in the agreement itself.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where do you find that it is, and I'm going to ask your opponent the same question, conferring exclusive agreement on Peru? There is an exclusive and a non-exclusive species of forum selection clause. The agreement says it shall be construed, interpreted, and enforced according to the laws of Peru, and that the parties consent to jurisdiction in Peru. Where does that clause say that Peru shall have exclusive jurisdiction?
Oh, you know, I'm not that smart. I think what you're asking, help me out, you have to go to Peru, in other words. So the difference between exclusive and non-exclusive, we could interpret it here in Nevada, but we would use Peruvian law.
Did you make that argument?
I would say, just if I look at this and interpret it as it reads, you could go either way. I don't know.
But you didn't argue in the district court that it was ambiguous or that it conferred non-exclusive jurisdiction in Peru?
All I said was it shouldn't apply.
Because the claims aren't tied to the contract.
Exactly. And I think the one point that I wanted to make about this particular clause is that it is so narrow. Our claims for relief do not arise from the agreement.
Mr. Butel, what do we do with Bremen versus Zapata Offshore? How do we analyze that in light of your facts?
I think the Bremen case is really, the more and more and more I study this case, the Bremen case really makes a lot of sense. But you have to take the first prong of the Bremen test, unreasonable and overreaching, and then that's where all these other cases flow as far as the interpretation of are there contracts and tort causes of actions that are interrelated and arise out of the same operative facts. If so, then it's probably not overreaching or unreasonable to apply the forum selection clause. So, you know, to the extent that I'm arguing that our causes of action have nothing to do with the documents, and so it is unreasonable under those circumstances. It is overreaching under those circumstances. It does fall within the Bremen test, that first prong of the Bremen test. And then the second prong, of course, too.
How do you respond to this, I guess, this line of authority that basically says, but for the parties entering into a contract, we wouldn't be here. The fraud is kind of a part of this amorphous contract.
But for the fact that Dean Maddox forked over $600,000, that's the operative event. If this scheme could have been carried out without a document, we'd still be here. And I don't think the documents are anything other than, I've used the word window dressing, they are tools in the bag of the fraud committed upon my client by Mr. Rosenberg. That's my interpretation of these contracts. So we're not here because of the contract. We're here with them as just a part of the story, telling it chronologically to the prior effect.
But you have to agree that but for the contract, your client would not have given $600,000 to this.
I don't know. I don't know how many guys would have done on would have done this on the basis of some sort of handshake or otherwise. It's kind of like the Flim Flam man who drives up in a Bentley with a slick suit and a wad of cash. Contracts just part of that whole facade. That's my interpretation, Your Honor, of the contract and how it was used in this case. It's a grifter's type of use. And I'm saying that if we adopted the same broad rule that I see in so many of the other cases, it plays in the hands of fraud that could be, used. You could use the law against people so easily to relieve them of any recourse because, Metro isn't going to prosecute a case like this. Oh, look, there's a contract. Bye. And then you go to the civil court and they say, well, look, there's a foreign selection clause. Move along.
Mr. Gudula,
yes, sir.
I'm sorry, did you wish to reserve any time?
Thank you for reminding me. There's my 2 minutes.
Okay.
Unless the court
has I didn't want to cut you off, but I wanted to remind you that you could reserve time if you wanted to.
I did reserve the time, Justices, and I better take leave.
Okay. All right. Mr. Jabowski?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, what the appellant is asking to do here today is take forum selection clauses wholesale and throw them, to use his terms, in the trash. Because any contractual dispute can be clothed in terms of tortious conduct, fraudulent breach, and then once you do that, you just do as the appellant has done here, and just say, we're not pleading on the contract, we're pleading a tort, the contract is, has nothing to do with this transaction. This can be as simple as a promissory note. A promissory note can have two terms in it. This is the repayment term, and jurisdiction shall be in, let's say, Vermont. Person sues here in Nevada. What do they sue for? Fraud. You did not breach the promissory note by not repaying it. You fraudulently converted the money from it. So I'm suing on the tort of getting the money back. And this is what the opponent is asking me to do, to open up the door to every single forum selection clause to be litigated before the entire case is heard. Somebody can plead around it because they want to be in Nevada or anywhere else. And then there'll be litigation as to whether or not there is a forum selection clause or not it applies. It's going to come up here, and that's going to be in every case before the case is even heard.
Well, perhaps, but do you agree, Mr. Dabowski, that forum selection clauses should be narrowly construed to what they say?
No. When parties bargain and negotiate for and choose a forum, it's because they have sat down and said, we have disputes, here is the place where we want these disputes to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be so clean each time, as we see from all those the cases that have been cited to in this court or in other cases. That sometimes they're tort. Sometimes they're cases that are related to. But the
court, well, why don't we examine the clauses in the various documents in this case? Is it correct that the transition here is a MOU followed by an agreement followed by an addendum? Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. Three separate agreements.
Okay. What governs this dispute? The forum selection clause in the MOU, the forum selection clause in the agreement, or the forum selection clause in the addendum? Because they seem to differ.
They differ, but if they differ, it's only slightly. The memorandum states any arising dispute will be in Peru.
Did the agreement supersede the MOU?
That was not something that was argued by the appellant. Again, the appellant position was that there wasn't a forum selection clause, but I don't believe they were. I believe these were all agreements that were all part of the same transaction.
The agreement had an integration clause stating that it was the exclusive embodiment of the party's contractual relationship to that point. Normally that would have extinguished or superseded the MOU, I think, is Justice Hardesty's point.
That may be. However, each one of the three does state that it is in Peru. The memorandum of understanding, the first one, does say arbitration in Peru. And as we know from the Bremen, in the cases that followed the Bremen, because the Bremen was an international admiralty arbitration forum selection clause, but the courts have said we treat those the same. The other ones that followed, the agreement says they consent to jurisdiction in Peru.
Would you agree that it is not an exclusive forum selection clause?
I respectfully disagree that it's an unconditional. It's an unconditional agreement that's where they want the parties agreed to arbitrate the case. And I think,
well, they say they consent to jurisdiction there, but they don't say that it must be brought in Peru, which is a distinction, I submit.
I understand the distinction. I think the problem with that is when parties do sit down and say, here is where we do want this case to be heard. In this case, as you can see, every aspect of this case was in Peru.
Well, it necessarily begs the question, if it's to be read as broad as you suggest, then why the language in the addendum, which seems to say that the forum selection clause is limited to two circumstances or two subjects.
If the
forum selection clause in the primary agreement is read as broadly as you suggest, what's the point in refining it to just two subjects in the addendum?
Well, the addendum, which was only, I believe, the second one, because there was also the tripartite, which was the third, and that one, if we're to go with the understanding that the agreements were to flow into the next, the tripartite in January of 2006 states any action related to this addendum. So, again, it's broadly worded. And I think one of the dangers...
Well, what did the addendum address?
The that was not, those facts were not developed in the trial court. It was all part of the development. All of it was the development of these sports and wagering ventures in Peru.
The addendum addressed simulcasting and tote services, according to its title, and I presume you submitted with your motion to dismiss the MOU, the agreement, and the addendum, correct?
Yes.
And nothing else?
In the record below, it was the agreements and whatever affidavits were submitted, and emails also were submitted.
What performance did the addendum contemplate on both sides?
And that is, I don't have that information offhand. Again, we did not develop the factual, those factual parts of the complaint. And again, the reason was the appellant did not raise them. The appellant concedes, I believe the appellant conceded here in front of you and in the district court, that the forum selection clause is unconditional, clauses, all three, do apply. Did not argue that they were, that the clauses themselves were the product of fraud, coercion, concealment, that they were not conspicuous, that Peru had no connection to the case, that they were not the product of arm's-length negotiations. None of those arguments were raised by appellant. So at the cost of their concession that the clauses were valid and the clauses were unconditional, that the case would be heard in Peru, the details, whatever distinction may be among the three agreements, was not developed. But I believe the reading of each one of the three is that it be in Peru. And I think with the way the courts read this is when parties negotiate for a forum is because they believe, listen, issues may arise, disputes may arise, the nature of business, but we think that whatever those disputes may be, this is the forum that's going to hear them. And that may be, there may be, obviously for disputes, there could be unforeseen disputes. If they're foreseen disputes, those could be easily resolved. But because they're unforeseen, the fact that parties sit down ahead of time and say, this is the forum. And that brings a good deal, and that brings the certainty to international and American business transactions that we need. If you don't have that certainty, you disrupt commercial transactions by saying that forum selection clause is one thing, but you can just plead around it, call it something.
I understand that, but you're asking us to interpret what on its face looks like a non-exclusive consent to jurisdiction in Peru as an exclusive forum selection clause. And I understand the waiver argument that wasn't presented in the district court, but would you agree with me that on its face, the agreement's forum selection clause is non-exclusive? It simply is a consent to jurisdiction in Peru, not a mandate that any dispute has to be brought in Peru.
As to that particular agreement, yes, but I believe the fact that it's not conditional shows what the party's intent was. Because if the party said consent to jurisdiction, and then carved out some other exception, I would say perhaps that would be. But because there are three agreements, and each one of the three agreements does state Peru, and each one of the three agreements does not give any qualification or condition upon what Peru is going to hear, and the fact that everything in this case took place in Peru, these were Peruvian ventures that were being developed, and not Nevada ventures, that it would still mean that jurisdiction under the forum selection clauses would be any litigation, arbitration would have to be in Peru under any of the three.
The court seemed to take differing approaches to how to resolve an exclusive forum selection clause, assuming that the court agrees with you that either, even though these clauses seem to be confusing, the argument that they're non-exclusive has been waived. Which approach should this court take in resolving this question and why? And with regard to that answer, I'd like you to specifically address why the court shouldn't consider the approach taken in Barrett versus Life Insurance Company of Southwest, a federal supplemental case out of Utah.
Thank you. I will address I urge this court to adopt the broad approach. As the broader approach says that when you have a forum selection clause, that is where the parties have chosen litigation to be, and again, disputes, most of which are going to be unforeseen, should be in that forum. And I do believe respectfully with the court's order, you have cited certain cases that state that those are case specific, but in reading those cases, I find that the courts in those cases said, well, we do have a forum selection, and it did arise out of the contract, or the facts were inextricably linked to the transactions, and therefore we're going with the broader approach. to go with approach that tries to be too specific, whether it's exclusive or otherwise, or whether or not the exception applies, just invites more uncertainty, because now all the parties, before we can get to the dispute, have to litigate whether or not the foreign selection clause would apply. But think about it. Why would parties transact and say, here's the forum we're choosing, in an arm's length negotiation, let's take that as a presumption, but say that when we're anticipating that if other facts do arise, and other disputes arise, those will be litigated in forums, fora that we have not recited here in the contract.
But under the test in Barrett, our district courts would be charged with the responsibility for examining the intention of the parties the wording of the particular clauses in each case before deciding whether there is indeed a non-exclusive forum selection clause. What's wrong with such a test?
The problem with that test is, again, it invites more litigation before the parties can even address the dispute. Because, again, to start the case with litigation.
Well, that happens every day in the district courts on arbitration clauses. I'm sure you're familiar with that. We might as well open the gates and let everybody have a free-for-all on forum selection clauses, too. But at least it does afford some direction. Was it really the intent of the parties to pick Peru, for example? And do the clauses themselves really declare approach? I'm not so sure that such a test doesn't enhance a true study about whether parties to contracts really intended to pick some unusual location for their forum.
When you say unusual, you're not referring to Peru in this case, are you?
No, I'm talking about subjects generally.
Yes.
That would ferret out, for example, the hypothetical, although I think unreasonable, but a hypothetical posited by Mr. Boutel that he practices or offers legal services here and selects Argentina for a dispute against him. I don't think anybody's going to really suggest that those kinds of contracts exist, but take, for example, contracts that establish mortgage fraud issues or mortgage fraud services where someone says, okay, I'll negotiate your mortgage or the modification of your mortgage for you, but if you're dissatisfied with my services, we agree to address that question in Chile.
Yes.
I think the test in Barrett would allow a district court to ferret out whether the parties really intended such a clause.
Well, I think, the scenario you're talking about is not very far off from this court's Tandy case. However, the Tandy case was just, I believe, 2 years prior to the U.S. Supreme Court's case in Shute versus Carnival Cruise Lines. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court said even a forum selection clause on the back of a ticket is valid. It's not negotiated, and it didn't even have much, I believe it was a Washington forum selection clause, and it may have been a Caribbean cruise or something along those lines, but the court said, no, this is what's printed on the back of the ticket, and that is a valid, and the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, enforced it.
But you are enforcing a clause, so your analysis has to begin with what the parties said in the contract, correct?
Yes.
And it's a contractual obligation, so you would be looking at how they expressed objectively their intent with regard to dispute resolution, correct?
Yes.
So it ends up coming back again to the clause itself, and what does it say?
That's why the broad approach is one that gives certainty to litigation in these cases. You can see that the courts.
But does it impose on parties an agreement that they didn't make?
No. You can see the courts have no problem imposing those requirements, from the Carnival Cruise Line being the most extreme example. But even so, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed with it. But the fact that the parties do sit down and do draft out, this is where you want to litigate the case, I think should have a tremendous amount of weight. And even where, by the one other case, the American Patriot case, which was a Seventh Circuit case in 2004, also, parties tried to plead fraud, and the court said no. The lawsuit was in Chicago, the case was in Bermuda, and they said no, the case has to be heard in Bermuda. And that was a 2004 Seventh Circuit case, American Patriot.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Dubowski? All right. Did you have any final thought you wanted to offer other than you want us to affirm?
No, again, I urge this court's affirmance. I believe you read through every single case that in this court's order, they all side in favor of forum selection clause. That is certainly the trend. Jurisdictions and high courts of every jurisdiction, including the circuits, the U.S. Supreme Court, and in this, back in the 70s until now, that's what the courts say. Listen, we need certainty in commercial transactions. We don't want people jockeying for litigation advantages by just choosing a form and pleading out of it, and pleading out of the clause. And if you had issues with some of the cases that allowed that, those cases were very distinguishable and very unique and egregious factual scenarios, and I'd be glad to address those if the court needed that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Poodle, your response.
Justices, I agree with Peter as far as interpreting contracts and causes of action tied to contracts. I absolutely agree. The first thing I said today was we should honor our form selection clauses. However, I think that we need to look at very helpful for me, the Armco case, where we have a case just like this one, where the serious, egregious actions of the defendant who's trying to enforce the form selection clause predate any contractual execution or even negotiation, and there the case that the form selection clause is not going to be honored. In Morgan, the tort claims didn't have anything to do with the product, sale of product or the contract, and they didn't honor the form selection clause. And then like this case, in Jitterswing, the court said the form selection clause does not cover torts. If tort actions in a complaint are going to be covered by a form selection clause, it needs to say so.
Are you attempting to make a distinction between those things that inducements or first arising under the contract?
I think that's a good... The fraudulent inducement to enter into a contract is not what we're getting at in our cause of action anyway. We're saying the fraudulent actions induced my client to fork over $600,000. There wasn't a fraudulent inducement to sign a contract. That's not what we're talking about. The fraudulent actions led to our clients forking over the $600,000, and that's why we're asking for the fraud, the conversion, and punitive damage. I don't like the artful pleading end run around form selection clauses that should be enforced any more than the court or Mr. Dubowski or anyone else that practices law. I think it's squirrely, and we have to avoid it. And the one thing that I was going to suggest was an evidentiary hearing that is convened at the request of a person seeking to enforce the form selection clause. The district court could determine very simply, by clear and convincing evidence perhaps, did the plaintiff try to dress this case up like a tort, but is he really going after contract-related relief? That's really the question. We have to protect both interests. And we have to protect people who, in good faith, engage in business but are hoodwinked. And we also need to protect people who have valid form selection clauses and valid contracts. So that's where the balance is. And my suggestion is that we take not a broad approach, but a very specific approach. Do the causes of action flow from this contract? In our case, it does not. It flows from the fraud. And the evidentiary hearing could very easily ferret out the posers from the legitimate cases.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Poodle. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Do you have any questions, Your Honor?
No.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Counsel, the court appreciates your advocacy this morning and your briefs in this case. The case will stand submitted.